Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and in this podcast, my guest reveals the five things from any time in their life that they would like to have in a time capsule. They pick four things they love and one thing they loathe and would like to bury and forget. My guest in this episode is the artist John Keane, whose commissioned works include a commission by the UN for a portrait of the former General Secretary of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, a portrait of Mo Modem by the National Portrait Gallery, John Snow for Channel 4, and Greg Dyke for the BBC. John is a political painter whose subjects often concern contentious political, social, and military issues. I say is a political painter, but very recently he announced that he was going to stop painting. So, as contentious as ever it would seem. John Keane's work has focused on many of the most pressing political questions of our age, and he came to national prominence in 1991 when he was appointed as official British war artist during the Gulf War by the Imperial War Museum. His work has always been deeply concerned with conflict, military, political and social, in Britain and around the world, and his subjects have included Northern Ireland, Central America and the Middle East, sometimes working with organisations such as Greenpeace and Christian Aid. More recent subject matter has addressed the difficult topics relating to religiously inspired terrorism, such as Guantanamo Bay, the Moscow theatre siege, and homegrown acts of violence against civilians. Not many still life paintings of flowers in his back catalogue then. So, let's find out why John Keane has, sort of, retired, and what he would take from his life to preserve in a time capsule. And for once, this is a chat where I was actually in the same room as my guest. Quite a thrill. I hope you enjoy it.
So, shall I begin?
Yeah!
Shall I begin?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, it's tough trying to think of things, but there are certain things kind of present themselves. And I suppose what, over the years, for me, things that might have somehow put me in the direction in which my life subsequently went. And one of that, I suppose, was art. I'm an artist. And so I was trying hard to think about what images, perhaps, that may have been particularly kind of crucial in that. And I arrived at one, probably when I was about 14 or 15. It's a painting by René Magritte. English translation of the title is Time Transfixed, from 1938. But since this obviously is audio, not visual, I will describe the image. It's basically the image of a steam locomotive emerging from a kind of Victorian fireplace. I can't remember precisely the occasion which I first saw this, but it represented for me just something. Oh, it's reality, but it's reality subverted somehow. And it, for me, what I suppose subsequently the process of becoming interested in art and eventually becoming an artist was, it represented a kind of alternative. I thought, at this time, I was at a very staid, conventional boys' public school. Mm. And this somehow thought, that, oh, that, yeah, there's a different, literally a kind of different reality. It doesn't have to be this. I was, essentially, I suppose, was not that much different from it as it might have been in Victorian times. I mean, it wasn't... I didn't suffer the most sort of brutal...
It's not flashman.
It wasn't quite, no. But it was, I suppose, a kind of brutal environment. But I have to say, thankfully, I didn't suffer, I don't think, any of the worst excesses. But it was that ethos. And coming across an image like this, and there were other images as well, and I was thinking, Dali and surrealism and so on, which I suppose first set me off in being interested in... I think I was already interested in making art, painting and so on, but this sort of provided a sort of an interest as a kind of something, a way of exploring this through making work, I suppose, about that. And I sort of became a little surrealist in my time. And this was my, I suppose, escape from the rather overwhelmingly conventional, staid and towing-the-line kind of ethos that public school was. And, of course, by producing images that sort of people were baffled by, I think, what's that all about? And there were these accusations, oh, you're a suit. Anyone who sort of stepped out of line was being... that was the accusation that was levelled of being sued. It's that way of belittling anyone who really doesn't conform, I suppose. And I think, yes, it was probably this image by René Magritte that I remember as being kind of significant in that process.
Yes, at a time when, of course, you could have chosen punk.
No, this is pre-punk.
Way before.
It's way before. I can tell you about punk later. But no. I mean, this is sort of late 60s, early 70s subcultures, right. Counterculture and all that. Yeah. Which there was, people were... people were getting albums by Jimi Hendrix or whatever and thing. And there was even a progressive music society at the school. So there were currents of contemporary culture that existed, but it was very much kind of peripheral to the whole thing. I mean, most of it was, academic and also being in the CCF, the corps, the military aspect. I went to a school that did have quite a strong military tradition, and I didn't identify with that at all.
No.
So it was, this discovery, I suppose, of art as an alternative reality. And I suppose, I have had my school to thank for that. And actually there was, to digress, there was a good art department, there was a good art master who was encouraging. But it was kind of fringe rather than mainstream. And it was my sort of way of rebellion, I suppose.
And I suppose also there's an element of survival there, isn't there, in some ways. You're either going to go down the mainstream, but then you're in a very competitive field, aren't you? If you say, okay, me and this little group here, we're on the side.
Yeah.
That's a sort of safe haven.
Yes. And I mean, I did have some good friends and people with interests in common. Not so much sort of visual arty or something, but maybe sort of literary, poetic and, whatever. But... yeah, it is, survival, I think, of finding a few like-minded souls. And, thankfully there were.
Mm. And also, that thing of being mysterious at 15, you don't feel at all mysterious. Mm. You feel as if everybody can see right into your soul. Mm. So actually suddenly finding something that you found mysterious that you could do.
Yes, that is your own territory.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you should use the word mysterious because... I think, there was an element of mysterious, of strangeness, of otherness, of a different reality. Literally, it's in the imagery, it sort of defies the reality of everyday experience and yet somehow carries a resonance from our subconscious, from our dreams, whatever, but nonetheless is important to our sort of mental narrative, I think.
Mm. I mean, it is the problem, but also the fascination that everybody who doesn't understand art, and I put myself in that category, finds that you look at something and you don't really understand it, but it still is fascinating.
Well, I think, so long as it is fascinating, the worst thing could be is boring, obviously, but fascinating, if it arouses your fascination, then that encourages you to investigate, find out more. And I think also art needs to draw you in somehow, not resist interpretation or admiration or whatever, but to draw in the viewer for reasons perhaps they don't necessarily understand themselves.
Mm. The strange thing that people always say, which is so I'm obviously going to say it, they always ask artists who do something seemingly dangerous or avant-garde or unusual or difficult to understand, they will say to them, can you actually draw? Do you know what I mean?
Yes. And I have this idea that, in a sense, all art is drawing. And when I say all art, I mean art in its many varied forms, from obviously from drawing, painting, visual art, but also words on a page, performance on a stage, film, whatever, in that it's a representation of life, in that what a draftsperson is doing is trying to physically represent in lines and so on the reality they see before them on a page, but also in other media. It's the same thing, but you're not using a line, you're not losing a pencil, you're using perhaps words or images or sequences of images or whatever. But the end result is, and it's the same, you know, if you look at a bad drawing, you say, well, you know, it's rubbish, isn't it? Because but if it is good or in any form, you say yes, because it somehow affirms in you a sense of, yes, this is what it's like to be human. And you recognise that. You recognise that through emotion or visually or whatever, or in whatever manner that the art itself is presented to you.
Mm.
And you say, yeah, I get that. And it means something to me and I respond. So it's another kind of drawing.
Yeah, well, I think human beings have an extraordinary ability to pick up signals from all sorts of things. So we can see a human form in three lines.
Mm.
And the fact that all humans can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Which shows that actually we have quite a deep understanding of...
Yes, well, absolutely. Also, I do think, you know, we're kind of hardwired through, you know, evolution to discern forms that resemble living beings in the way that... I mean, it's one of my themes has been over the years has been Rorschach test, butterflies, seeing images in blobs... And how butterfly wings with eye spots resemble other creatures that may deter predators, therefore they're not predated, and therefore they survive to reproduce. And the more accurately the representation of reality in their mimicry, the more they survive and the better the mimicry. And that's something I explored. It was actually after a trip I did to the Amazon with Greenpeace in 2000, I think it was, on one of their anti-logging campaigns. I just came across a butterfly, not in the rainforest, but actually in a natural history museum, an owl butterfly with the most incredible eye spots, down to almost, you know, the highlight in the pupil of the eye.
Wow.
And the degree of naturalism, of realism, that any artist might strive to get was there, just, you know, on the wing of a butterfly that had evolved somehow.
Mm.
And I was just struck by that and thinking, where does that come from? So I started reading up about, you know, evolutionary theory and blah, 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 blah. I recognise, you know, there is. Or is it? Is it God? Is it... No. It's evolution.
The great clockmaker. Where does a clock come from?
Exactly. But, you know, so I was reading Richard Dawkins and all that stuff. But it kind of set off that train of thought. And I think beings, creatures, humans are hardwired to recognise images, I suppose, for survival.
Yeah,
for their own survival, in a way.
Yes. And that whole evolution thing, people always forget to put into it time.
Oh, yes. The huge thing. Actually, look at we have on the wall here, Charles Darwin and a chimpanzee. This is a piece I did from around that time of Charles Darwin looking uncannily like a chimpanzee.
Like a chimp.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Anyway, I never meant to get onto that subject, but there we are.
So, having decided or discovered the Magritte painting and others like it, did you start to paint in the style of people?
I became a surrealist, yes. Actually, to be honest, I was probably more into Dali at that time and sort of devoured anything I could, any image or, you know, books that I could find, whatever. So, yeah, I did. But that maybe lasted a year or two. But that was my entry point. It was the entry point into the art world. And then I got interested in other things. I became an abstract painter for a bit, Arthur. You know, I explored all kinds of ways of making art. And that was, you know, even before going to art school. And then I went to art school, which in itself was sort of quite stifling, I think. It was very figuratively based, which was useful, but,
And so what, you covered everything?
I covered everything. Yeah. Well, not quite everything, but I was, you know, I was interested. Just what's going on, and, you know, what's going on in contemporary art at that time and so on. So, yeah, I wanted to absorb it all, and you find things that interest you and you find things that you don't respond to.
I mean, I'm always interested in the idea of when you find your own voice in those things. If you fall in love with music because you hear the Beatles, the first few songs you're going to write are undoubtedly going to be like yesterday.
Well, exactly. And I think, obviously early work is very derivative and you are looking over your shoulder all the time. And actually, sometimes you find yourself, as I did, sort of doing paintings. I thought, God, I've sort of seen that before. And it does bear an uncanny resemblance.
Morgan with his half smile.
Yes,
oh,
yes, exactly. But, you know, that is kind of unconscious. It's not deliberate. And you think, oh, God. And it slightly distracts from the, you think, oh, that's really good. Oh, I'm not the first person to do that.
Yeah.
But it's what you say about finding a voice, and that kind of came later, some years after leaving art school, which I sort of struggled for quite a while. And when I found, I suppose, what became my theme or, you know, my motivation, which, you know, as you know, it's war, conflict, politics and so on. It was the Falklands War, actually, that set me off on that particular... I was just so angry, outraged that I'd found myself in a country that's in a state of war over some colony that no one ever heard of. And our, you know, young men were going to be shipped off to fight and possibly to their deaths. And anyway, so that was a kind of catalyst then.
Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose we ought to talk about why you've decided to stop being an artist.
Well, I don't know if I've stopped being an artist. I don't know if you can. But you're right, Mike. I have stopped making art for, well, I suppose... really, since the outbreak of the pandemic. I had a show which was due to open basically the day everything shut down, so it never opened. And that, it, I suppose, I've been at the back of my mind. There'd been a lot of questions going on about my work, you know, my artistic output and process and so on. It's the emotional investment in making work, which over the years, I suppose, you spend a lot of time alone in the studio producing what, you know, you think is this, you know, terrific stuff and waiting for approbation and celebration and sales, of course, you know. But it's kind of, it's the emotional investment tended to not really be justified by the end product. And I was just feeling that... each show I would do would be like, you know, you'd be climbing another mountain. There's a lot of effort involved. And you think at the end of it, does the gratification really justify what I've put into that? And I found, as you know, in recent years, it hasn't. And I just thought, well, actually, let's just take a break. Let's just, there was a natural pause because of the pandemic and so on. And obviously, it was very disappointing that the show was... cancelled. But it also gave me time to reflect on how I wanted to spend my time. And I, you know, over the years, I've been working as an artist for many, many years. I've sold a lot of work over that time. There was a lot of work also I haven't sold that remains in store. And I thought, well, do I really want to carry on contributing to this painting mountain that someone at some point will have to process, deal with, burn? I don't know. But, you know, that's been down to my kids or whatever. And I, you know, I just felt, well, okay, for the time being, that's enough. And it was a sort of natural process. And believe, strangely enough, it's also a great relief. It's almost a bit like a burden has been lifted. I don't feel I need, because, you know, it's hard to know what motivates you to get up in the morning and make work. But over the years, there's been enough of that for me to do that. And that was just, I suppose, sort of on the wane, enough to make me decide that, well, let's just give it a rest.
So was it the work in the end that you were disappointed with?
I think my work has got better and better over the years. And perhaps this is where, you know, because I don't feel that has been duly acknowledged or indeed rewarded, you know, in whatever sense. And so I think, well, I've explored many different ways of working and different themes, and it's all been interesting and exciting, and I've enjoyed most of it. That, you know, there are ups and downs, and I do feel over the years that my practice has got better. Which, you know, is always good, you know, to look back and think that, you know, that is the trajectory. However, I don't feel that's been reflected in professional recognition or indeed selling work and so on. So I just think, well, you know, if I'm just making this just to go into storage, is it really worth it?
Do you feel that the work that you have sold has been bought by people who appreciate it, or do you think they bought it as investments?
I think if anyone bought my work as an investment, they'd be a very foolish investor. I think people have bought my work over the years because it means something to them and they like it. And you know, if they've bought it as an investment, then fine, that's up to them, but there won't be a great return on it. But no, that is gratifying that people part with their hard-earned cash because they like what I've made.
Yeah.
And that is part of the vindication, I suppose, of the, you know, I do this, someone actually, you know, wants to spend money on it. And yeah, great. And that's sort of the reassurance that you look for to know that what you're doing actually means something to someone other than yourself.
Yes.
Because, you know, let's face it, I mean, you're talking about, you were saying that talking to an artist, you know, might be rather different from people who just want to show off because they're an entertainer. But if you really, you know, art, there is a big element of showing off in art as well.
Yeah.
There is a big element, you know, I'm honest, it's about ego too and all of that. And so, not in the same way, but it'd be wrong to deny that that isn't an element of it. And if that's not, you know, that's my ego isn't satisfied enough, I think, well, just, you know, let's give it a break for a bit. And actually, like I said, there's a sort of a bit of a lifting of a burden.
Yes.
As well.
And maybe in time that may bring you back round to it with a whole new approach.
Yeah. Well, who knows? I mean, I don't, you know, I don't shut the door on anything.
No.
And, you know, actually, a lot of it's quite dull and boring as well. And, I, you know, the making, the graft.
It's like watching paint dry.
I couldn't have put it better myself. Literally.
Yeah. And yet I do, I mean, here we are in your house, and as you say, you have Darwin on one wall, and then the most beautiful painting of your children looking at a starlit sky with their backs turned to the artist, which I think is what makes... What makes it...
But they're looking at the universe.
But, you know, the loss of youth and them growing up, and yeah. it's all in it.
Well, I don't know if you remember the illustration for Start Right Shoes. Do you remember the illustration?
Yes.
Start Right Shoes, the little boy and little girl walking up the avenue of life with...
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Mm.
That's a kind of quote as well.
And I do remember the painting that was there before, which you did... For your wife?
I did a portrait of them. Looking at me.
And again, I can see the development of that.
Yeah.
You know, and these are your private, personal
paintings. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, there is a development there. Mm. In that one, your son was forward and young and enthusiastic. Your daughter was drifting back a bit.
Yeah.
You can see that reflected in the fact.
Very observant of you, Mike. Yeah, that's growing up. It's called growing up.
Growing up. Growing up, is that what it's called?
No, it's not called growing up.
That's what growing up is.
I
understand, yes. I've caught up slowly.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, that's, So I think that what you're saying in your art, to me, has always been very, very powerful and immediately strikes me. So I think it's you'll have to get some of those things out of storage and stuff.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I will at some point, yeah.
Great.
The other thing was, during the Falklands, was that... they appointed a war artist who then it was an artist called Linda Kitson. And I thought, a war artist?
Ooh.
Blimey, I want to do that. And funnily enough, you know, a few years later I did. But anyway, that notion had never entered my head before. Although obviously I had seen the work of, you know, Paul Nash and Spencer and Sargent and so on, whatever, before. But that an appointed official... war artist was a notion I hadn't really come across.
Yes. I would think that one of the great problems at that stage in your life would be trying to work out how on earth you would make a living doing something.
There was a lot of that, yeah. I'd made a living, after leaving art school and being a bit directionless. Actually, this sort of ties into possibly my next entry in the...
This is if we've worked it
can
out.
We just segue...
Of course we can.
...seamlessly into
it's,
that?
It's going to sound as if I'm skillful.
Because you, be you seem to be drawing this out of me, is my diary. I kept a diary from the age of about... So just about 15, and it lasted all the way up until I think I was just 30. So that's a good few years. That was sort of 15 or 16 years. And these are the most, as we all remember, the most formative, poignant, awful, wonderful years of our life. And I've recently been rereading it. It's sort of cringing and... but it's a fascinating document, and it actually is... a time capsule in itself, because reading it through, and it's something that's quite detailed, and it kind of, it's a shortcut between my brain now and how I felt then, and it's kind of, it's quite a strange, and sometimes it sort of evokes all kinds of emotions, actually. Some of them, as I say, just make me want to squirm.
Ooh.
Others, I think, oh, my God, you poor boy.
No.
Did you? Oh no! Don't. Yeah, but it somehow it's very vivid. It's very. So that what we were talking about the evolution of my artistic practice. There were some years that I did, you know, couldn't find my own voice, and they covered this period of, you know, the Falklands War and so on, and that it's a way of somehow. Forming the narrative of my own history, which is quite interesting. I don't know how, if you think back about your own past and you remember certain episodes and it's a bit of a jumble and some things stand out, some things you've probably forgotten.
People always say that I have a very good memory for these things, but maybe it's why I've never written a diary.
Maybe.
I do remember things in great detail.
Oh, well, that's good. Also handy for your profession, isn't it?
I suppose so, yeah.
In my own case, my memory is a bit of a jumble, but it sort of puts it in order and is quite sort of revelatory. And at this point in my life, which is... I'm not a young man anymore. It's interesting to reflect back on that now.
Yeah. And are you able to put yourself back in that position? Do you understand this young man?
Yes. I mean, it changes over the years, because obviously when I started, I was an adolescent, very immature. And I could, you know, see myself getting a bit older and wiser and learning. And so I sort of relate more to the more recent end of the diary, where I feel that's someone a bit who resembles a bit more what I am now than when I was sort of 15 or 16. And that's just the process of hopefully getting older and acquiring some kind of wisdom for whatever, you know.
What is it that made you... Well, what stopped you writing a diary?
I was happy.
Ah.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. I was happy. I mean, so I was beginning to get some recognition in my work. I was in a relationship, and so much of the diary is about awful, tortured relationships with women, or lack of. And in the end, that kind of felt things were beginning to fall into place. But that you know, was really sort of in my, not until my late 20s, I guess.
Mm.
And I've actually took a picture of the last page, and it is... page 2,499 or something. I mean, it is literally, I mean, it's about almost 2,000. I mean, it was on loose leaf files that I had when I was at school, wrote in files. And it, I said, things seem to be going well, I think, was
that's
one of
your
the last.
Sort
of. It sounds a bit like saying, I may be some time. I think that, you know, it's actually... If to reduce it to that, is that's as simple as that.
Yes. And then I suppose that is then reflected.
That wasn't the end of unhappiness as well. You know, it felt like things go... Anyway, yeah, go on.
No, I mean, I think that sort of becoming settled or certain, more certain of yourself and your position, that then gets reflected in your work, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a sort of growing confidence and a sense of my own voice, I suppose. Mm. Yeah, that all contributed to that.
Yeah, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but what I've always admired about your work is that it seems that you have something very clear to say, and then you're brave enough to then muddy it as it were. Am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, well, things are never clear-cut. There's always ambiguity. I mean, things are strange, you know, back in René Magritte, why is this steam locomotive emerging from the fireplace? You know, what is the logic to that? But so, yes, and that excites your interest. And human beings are fallible, frail, and contradictory. And all these things are fraught with difficulties and contradictions. Those sort of things I quite like exploring sometimes. Ooh. Yeah.
Yes, and the acceptance of people seeing your work and putting their own spin on it, interpreting it their own way.
Yeah, well, I think inevitably that's the case. I think with art, and again, art of in any medium, you fill in the blanks, and that's, you do a bit of work, and that's where the reward lies. And the artist provides the stimulus for that, and you maybe supply your own answers. I do, because you don't want to browbeat people with ideology or whatever. That just drives people away. But just maybe invite thought or reflection, or just say, well, look, this is my take.
And it might not necessarily produce the thoughts that you intended, I think. Probably. I do remember an exhibition of yours just after you'd come back from Palestine. There were some extraordinarily beautiful paintings of people standing by the wall and overhearing two people talking about it, and one person saying, look at that, all that to keep that boy out.
Seriously?
Yes.
And that was intended seriously, wasn't
it? Absolutely intended seriously.
Yes.
Well, yes.
But that's a very interesting way of describing it, and there's a lot of truth in that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose you're never going to publish these diaries.
Actually, I don't think anyone would want to. I'm not sure. They would have to be heavily edited, I think, by me first. A few years ago, Mark Lawson did a monograph about me, and he wanted to see the diaries. Like, I resolutely refused.
Very wise.
But honestly, it's too much for anyone. Someone would have to be very, very dedicated.
Yes. Have to be very, very dead.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But actually, there are other things. You know, things some of it makes me laugh. I mean, you know, I could be quite witty occasionally. And also there are occasionally references or messages to me now, you know, me in the future. And I just think, oh, that's me as, you know, when I was 20-something talking to me now in my 60s. And it's kind of weird, but rather nice in a way. It's just sort of imagining myself in the future, looking back at this.
I mean, if you're writing it, you think, so, well, I'm going to hold on to these.
Yeah.
So one day I'll be looking at this again when I'm old.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. I mean, actually, to be honest, when I was an adolescent, a teenager, I didn't expect to be old, which is, I suppose, part of my makeup psyche then, was that I fully didn't expect to live past the age of 30.
Why?
Because I couldn't envisage it. I don't know. I was a bit nihilistic and negative about everything. But anyway, you know, here I am.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose there was a kind of despair at certain times where, you know, because I was unhappy quite a lot frequently, you know, and I thought, well, you know, what's the point, in a way?
Ooh.
But, you know, you carry on with the grind and you carry on banging your head against the brick wall, and eventually the cracks begin to appear in the brick wall and not your head.
Yeah.
I suppose so many people go through the same, you know, there's nothing special about my experience. I'm sure it's the same with lots of people who also have much worse experience. I mean, I had the benefit of a very supportive family. They hadn't a clue what I was doing, really. You know, they didn't know that my father was a stockbroker. He had no idea about the art world. But they, you know, they never didn't support me. Yeah, so.
Oh, but you say nihilistic. I was so nihilistic, I didn't even imagine that I would ever grow old. So it never bothered me.
Yeah, so you just carried on.
I found to stay as wonderful as young and...
Well, you are, Mike. You are.
Of course I am. Of course I am, John.
Forever youthful.
I'm going to take your diaries from 15 to 30 and we'll put them safely in your time capsule. I think we'll put in the René Magritte
Yep, time transfixed.
Yes, let's nick that from a gallery somewhere.
Yeah, it's in Chicago, I think.
Right, okay. There, yeah. I'm sure, you know, nobody will listen to this. Nobody will know we've done it.
No.
But that's that's where it is.
Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. So if everything goes pear-shaped, you've always got them agreed in the back pocket. You know?
Yeah.
Lovely. Okay. So what's number three?
So you want another one now?
Yeah, moving on.
Thanks for listening to this midway point in the podcast, where, as I'm sure you know, there is traditionally an ad break. Far be it from us to break the tradition. See you in a moment.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome back to My Time Capsule of the artist, retired, possibly, John Keane. Let's find out what else he'd like to put in his time capsule, and the one thing he'd like to banish to a hole in the ground and never think of again.
Yeah, Sadler's Wells.
Right.
I wish someone had told me about modern dance earlier in my life. I'd been to one or two things maybe at Sadler's Wells when I was younger, but probably in the mid-90s, and I went to... Someone had some tickets for a performance of Pina Bausch, and I went to see that. And this was just... I don't know, I was utterly transfixed, absorbed. And through that, I got more interested in contemporary dance. I mean, just because... There's something about live performance, and obviously you will understand this, although you're not a dancer.
Maybe.
But there's something about the power of live performance that is kind of unique. It can't be reproduced in any other way. And if you're there experiencing it. And dance, which entails movement, and for me, music, which is fundamentally so important throughout my life, is just something that, when it works, it's extraordinary. Mm. And Sadler's Wells, I've been to, I don't go, you know, every week or anything, I maybe go two or three times a year, but occasionally I come up with dance groups and things that I just think, this is just extraordinary that... Mm. Quite a few. There's Hofer Schächter, or I've mentioned Pina Bausch, and Crystal Pite, the most extraordinary and gut-wrenching performance there a few years ago. And it's just extraordinary. I just wish someone had told me about that when I was younger. I also had the benefit of the dance critic of The Observer, Luke Jennings, who for a while made me his plus one for when he was going to, reviewing dance as well. And it's that thing about theatre, performance, music, movement. It has its own logic. It doesn't conform to anything. It doesn't have to have a narrative. It doesn't have to be like the conventional stage plays or whatever. But again, it may have an element of the inexplicable, strange things. And when it works, it has a potency that I haven't really found anywhere else.
Right.
So, yeah, so...
Who did tell you about it?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I knew about it. I'd been to one or two things. I mean, I knew Sadler's Wells was there, but it was maybe just going to my first live Pina Bausch performance in the 90s. And I think I'd heard of her, and I'd sort of seen the odd video or whatever, and I thought, oh, that looks interesting. Yeah, so I don't know what your feelings are about dance, ballet?
Dance, I find absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And yet I'm not dedicated to it. Mm. I mean, unfortunately, I'm one of those people in life who says, yeah, that's fantastic, and then I just carry on with my normal life.
Yeah.
Clearly, I have things in my life, I think, that take precedent.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. For me, that's always been bath time for children.
Yeah. Well, I know. Well, but, you know, I know with you and kids, it's just, there's no contest, is it?
Yeah. No. If anybody asks me what I was going to put into a time capsule, that's definite.
Right.
I am
right.
Slowly leaking out the things. That's a definite.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been the joy of my life.
Yeah. Well,
your children are now grown up.
Yeah, 24 and 19.
Yes. So possibly heading towards being a granddad.
Yeah, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yes.
But I, you know, I suppose that with grandchildren, I mean, yes, I like kids, but I suppose if I were to be blessed with grandchildren, it would be that thing of, yes, okay, you can have them back now.
It's
that,
yeah.
You know, we've enjoyed them long enough.
Yes, yeah. And in life, you're much more of an observer and a commentator, yes, I think, than you are a participant.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true, actually, yeah.
Oh, and I don't mean that in a rude way.
No. That's a very shrewd observation. I mean, it's also, you know, politically as well, I'm more of a commentator. I'm not an activist. I don't want to get involved. I feel very uncomfortable doing that. But I do want to observe, yeah.
Yes. So I'm trying to think of the sort of contemporary dance that I've seen. And actually, I find I'm not really bothered about the standard of it. You know what I mean? Mm. When you see extraordinarily well-trained ballet dancers doing modern dance. It's extraordinary what they can do with their bodies.
Yeah.
But I find it just as interesting and, in fact, as rewarding to watch a bunch of... Well, I'm the honorary president of a children's theatre group, and whenever they do dance in that, it moves me more than the singing or the acting.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, that's because it is something. And actually, this might just segue neatly into my next choice.
Okay.
Before I do that, it's just people moving in unison.
Yeah.
I think people moving together to a rhythm or music, you know, line dancing or something like that. It's just something that, it kind of hits something in your brain that you think there's something rather special about that. And and it doesn't have to be brilliantly disciplined. In fact, probably what is, you know, if it is brilliantly disciplined, you think of, you know, goose-stepping soldiers or something, nothing could be more, you know, soulless than that, frankly, and they're all moving in unison. However, when you do see people voluntarily getting together, it's like, you know, those sort of flash mob things, you know, that people sort of trend with those. I thought, you know, fantastic. And actually, that does, actually... I'm doing a job for you now.
That's all right.
Move me into my next item for the time capsule, which is the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympics.
Right. Tell me about it, because I'm afraid I was so drunk that I missed most of it.
Oh, God, Mike.
I know. Seriously. I was so excited.
There was one day in the summer when on the Today programme they played the Underworld theme. It's by Underworld, which sort of ran throughout the opening ceremony or you know, recurred from time to time. The waterworks it just all came back. And in fact, it's almost doing that now, I'm thinking about it. But I found the whole thing so moving. And it was this participation of people. I mean, I don't know how much of it you do remember, but...
I exaggerate. I do remember.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like obviously the NHS sequence and things like that, and these
tree of life. I thought was just
and there, you know, there was Kenneth striding out as Brunel, and it just was absolutely brilliant.
There is a connection there because you say that overly regimented movement of people together can seem sort of too clinical.
Yeah,
what was marvellous about that opening ceremony was that it was clearly astonishingly well organised.
Yes.
But at the same time, had a freedom to it.
Yes. And I think, you know, that's probably because of the involvement of so many groups of different diverse groups of people.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I was a total sceptic about the Olympics beforehand. You know, I'm not that interested in sport. I sort of thought, oh, God, the Olympics in London, it's just going to be a nuisance, you know, it's going to slow the traffic down or something. And then I watched it. It was in Suffolk, and we was with the family, and we just watched it on a small TV screen, and I was just transfixed. I was a convert from that moment on. And then the next morning I just watched it all through again. Honestly, it was just amazed. And I take my hat off to Danny Boyle and Frank Cottrell-Boyce and everyone, you know, who's involved in it. And it was just a triumph, a total triumph. And particularly now, in view of everything that has transpired since politically in this country, it marks the end of an era.
It really did.
And it was, you know, it's actually seen as a kind of almost a, in certain ends of the political spectrum, as a kind of subversive, you know, and lefty. But it, for me, it kind of did represent so much of what I like about this country. And it was all beautifully, beautifully assembled and put together.
Yes. It does feel like as if it was the last time that as a nation we were unified.
Exactly, yeah. And since then it's just been division and fragmentation. Mm. And we all know where we are now. So there's a kind of a nostalgia, I suppose, looking back at it.
Ooh.
But then, yeah, I did. It completely, in the space of a couple of hours, converted me to the Olympics as a thing. I thought, great, fantastic.
Did you go?
Wonderful. I didn't. But my son did. He went to various... I mean, he was only 10 at the time. He went to quite a lot. He's got invited to a lot of things. He'll come back and tell us about them and so on. But I did, you know, I followed it on TV and so on. I kept an interest in it. But I thought it was stunning. And,
yeah.
You know, as a work of art, I think it was extraordinary. Mm. And then a few days after that, I was at a birthday party and Frank Cottrell-Boyce was there and I was sort of in awe of him. I thought, my God, you're involved in this...
Do you know Will Bowen?
I do, not very well. We've met, yeah.
But he designed the Tree of Life.
Did he? I didn't even know that.
Yes.
Really? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that. Well, I knew, yes, I knew he's a very well esteemed designer, theatre designer and all that, but I didn't know that he did that. Oh, well, there you go.
I have to take my hat off to him too.
But, it, you know, like I said, I just... When I heard that theme again and the children's voices singing, I just blubbed and blubbed. It's pathetic.
No, I think it's great. We should hold on to these things in life, I think.
Yeah.
These great moments. And that undoubtedly, out of what may well have been a hopeless moment, I mean, you would have imagined, looking at his history, that anything started by Boris would have fallen apart at some point.
Yeah.
But actually, through the efforts and the work of thousands and thousands of people, you get this extraordinary thing. Mm. I mean, I did go to the Olympics.
Did you?
The people working on it, the friendliness of the whole thing, the efficiency of it all was astonishing. Mm.
And there's just a spirit of cooperation.
It was absolutely
common enterprise. Brilliant.
I mean, I was in tears most of the time,
just
watching people run around a track. Yeah. And I took my newborn first grandchild with me, and I have a photograph of him draped in a Union Jack, you know, with the stadium behind him, and I should treasure it
fantastic.
Forever.
Fantastic, yeah.
Yes, right. That's a lovely thing to choose.
Yeah, well, has anyone chosen that before?
No.
Oh, I'm surprised.
Well, I suppose it's that personal thing. Mm. It feels very personal.
There's also, I mean, it is personal because it's the time with the family as well, and watching it as a family with the kids. That's part of the mix.
Lovely. Okay, so we've got one final thing to put in, which is something you want to reject from your life.
Public school.
Ah, where we started.
Which is where, we've done the full circle. And with that, I'd say the public school system, which I think is a pernicious continuation of a small group of individuals, families, institutions and so on that continue to dictate life in this country. And it's just, you know, it's wrong. It's wrong. I, of course, have been the beneficiary of that, but also... I feel I also haven't been... I had a public school education. I went to quite a posh school, and I did quite well there. But in the end, it didn't really have much to offer me in the career I subsequently pursued, since I didn't go to Oxbridge and I didn't join the Scots Guards or work in the city.
Which would have been the intention of sending you there.
I mean, I don't in any way blame my parents. I mean, for them...
No, they would have seen that as a safe future.
Absolutely. And that's what you did. And people of their background, their class, that is what you did. But, you know, it was a brutal kind of environment for a... I mean, I went to, you know, I sent away to school aged 8 initially, which I think is just cruel, actually.
Mm.
But, you know, I survived, and I like to think I'm a sort of reasonably well-balanced individual. Unpleasant things happen, but nothing like as unpleasant as some of the things you hear described. So I don't, you know, I wasn't a casualty. But now, you know, we live in an Etonocracy, And I think that is, in the 21st century, that is just wrong.
That is bizarre, isn't it?
It is bizarre. And it makes me ashamed, actually, of who this country is. And is, in fact, in a way, it's almost sort of reinforced now. That's what. Because he felt the country was becoming a bit more of a.
They started doing the hoovering upstairs.
They started doing the hoovering upstairs. That's typical, isn't it? Do you want me to go and have a word upstairs? Or is that going to...
I think it's come to an end.
Okay. All right.
I agree with you. I have to say I'm in complete agreement that I find it really bizarre that we constantly accept that situation.
Precisely. Yeah.
I can't understand a lot of working class people just saying, well, that's all right then. Hmm. Almost as if, you know, it ought to be that way.
Yes, this sort of hat-doffing, forelock-tugging tradition that persists, actually. And they think, well, that's okay. But I don't know. It's... Yes, you're right. People do seem to accept, or just, you know, that is what's normal. I mean, you know, I could throw in the monarchy as well, but...
Well, I think that's part of it. But the thing I don't understand is if you throw a few crumbs to people from not well-off backgrounds and allow them to come to your school, and as a result you get charitable status...
Yeah. Oh no. Well, that yes. I mean that is absurd. Yes. If that were removed, that would cause a significant change, I think. But no one really has the temerity to.
Yeah, but it ought to be, shouldn't it? They ought to be honest about what they're doing. If you say, okay, look, if you're just going to set up very special schools with wonderful facilities, and you're rich enough to pay for it, and you're going to live outside of the rest of society, we'll all have to put up with what we can get of the state.
Yeah.
Then be honest about it.
Precisely. Precisely. And it doesn't bear scrutiny at all. But that's the way it is. And until that status is removed, I'm sure they will continue to flourish. And, you know, because wealth has become more and more concentrated and polarised now, there's always the market for it.
And why would you give up that position of power as well?
Why, indeed. Why, indeed? Why, you know, who would willingly renounce it?
Yes.
When does that ever happen?
Come and join my society. John, thank you so much. I'll let them get on with the hoovering upstairs.
Okay.
And say thank you for being on My Time Capsule. It's been lovely to talk to you. It's been really fascinating.
It's been a great pleasure, Mike, and thank you for inviting me.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, John Keane. I look forward to being in the room with more people soon. But it does work pretty well online, as you can find out if you subscribe to this podcast, as we will let you know when any new episode is released and have it ready for you to download or stream. Aren't we nice? Right, before you leave us, or maybe skip to another episode, please take the time to rate the show. It really helps with the podcast profile. Whatever that means. You may even get the chance to review it, so be kind. You can see what's going on with me and My Time Capsule if you follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. Feel free to chat away. We love getting messages. Well, most of them. You can listen to the theme tune by Pass the Peas Music on Spotify anytime. This has been a cast-off production. Produced, or even produced if you prefer actual English, by John Fenton Stevens. Right, time to relax. I can't spend my entire life doing podcasts, you know. A man's going to have some me time. My latest way to relax is golf, which I've recently taken up. They say it's hard. But the first time I played it, I hit 2 birdies and an eagle, and a cow and 3 horses. I was bloody useless, so I'll leave you with this warning. 4! Bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.